Today is September 11th, of course, the 13th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on America. Observations to honor the victims and first responders are being held in places like Wentworth Park in Lansing, where Lansing Remembers started at 8:30 this morning. Mason Cares at the fire station on Ash Street from 1 to 7 p.m. today. Another at the Williamston Fire Station tonight at 6 p.m. and probably others in your town. While we reflect on what happened that day 13 years ago, we also consider how the effects of 9/11 attacks, linger in the world today. In recent weeks, we've seen the beheadings of two American journalists, Stephen Sotloff and James Foley, bringing to light the danger faced by journalists around the world today. To learn more about how dangerous a profession journalism can be, we've invited MSU journalism professor Eric Friedman to our studios. Eric's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter whose teaching work here at Michigan State now includes teaching a class on global affairs to graduate students. He's traveled the world meeting reporters to learn how they work in this atmosphere. Eric, welcome to Current State.
I'm glad to be here.
And we're also joined by Doigo Kanvar, a PhD student at Michigan State from Turkey. Her master's thesis was on the imprisonment of Turkish journalists, a number of whom she interviewed after their imprisonment. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Eric, let's start with you. The grisly murders of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff brought this topic to mind because of their bloody nature and because they were both Americans. But violence against journalists is nothing new. We remember the killing of Daniel Pearl in Pakistan back in 2002 as well. But reporters are in danger all over the world all of the time, and of course not just Americans. How much do we know about the prevalence of violence, kidnapping, and so on, of journalists?
One of the journalism and press rights advocacy groups, the Committee to Protect Journalists, keeps track of that, and as of yesterday, had counted 36 journalists killed so far this year, plus 8 media workers. The media workers are often the translators or the fixers who help correspondents around the world. The two largest locations for murders this year were Syria and Iraq, but in 15 countries so far this year, at least one journalist has been killed doing his or her job.
And Doigo Kanvar, you've met with a number of Turkish journalists after they had been imprisoned. And last year, Turkey had more journalists in prison than countries like Iran and China, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Why that? Why is that?
There are some, certain reasons that are posed by the government or the legal institutions claiming that these journalists are actually terrorists. But the public also knows deep down that they are usually imprisoned because they are critical against the government right now. And curiously enough, they were all released this year right before the presidential elections, just to not make the public angry anymore.
And Turkey is a unique situation. Here we have a Muslim country, predominantly Muslim country, that has adopted a good many of the features of the West. Can you speak to that? Does that figure into this?
It does, and actually, it's the reason of all the problems that are caused in Turkey, because we are really in between being a Western society or a more Middle Eastern religious society. We're basically a secular country. We don't have an official religion. But in the meantime, it is said that more than 90% of the population are Muslim. And that's also, that's a good thing that we are still westernized, but it's also the cause of problems.
What kind of conditions were the journalists that you visited held in?
So they said they were held in cells, and they were just, isolated. They were just, imprisoned one by one, and that caused a lot of, depression because they didn't have anyone to talk to. But then during their time in prison, they were actually continuing to write and inform people, so they weren't frightened. But of course, it was very depressing.
How long were they held?
Depends, but one of the journalists who was actually the chief editor in a mainstream daily He was held in prison for 6 years for no reason, actually.
And others were held for shorter periods of time?
Depends from, so it varies between 2 weeks to, like I said, 6 years.
And again, explain to us how the government justified their release. How did they describe that?
Their trials are still pending. There were no charges brought against them. And they were basically in jail, not in prison. And so during their jail time, the government brought this limit to their jail time, and the maximum should be 5 years pending trial. And in that case, they had to release them because they were, like, in prison, in jail for more than that time.
But I want to make sure I understand. Was the editor that was held for 6 years never charged?
Never charged,
oh,
yeah. He's still not charged.
My word. What do you make of this, Eric?
Governments have a lot of power to use laws, and often they're vague, national security, insulting the honor and dignity of the president, so that you don't have to, as a journalist, commit something that for somebody else would be a crime. It's as government interprets it. And by putting you in jail, not only does it get you off the air or out of print, but it intimidates your news organization and other journalists and has a ripple effect on the ability of the press to focus on public issues and force the government to be transparent and responsive on policy and corruption.
Are there many other reasons that reporters get imprisoned besides the ones we touched on here?
Sure. Well, in fact, there's an American reporter for the New York Times, James Risen, who is threatened with being held in contempt of court for refusing to identify a confidential source for a book he did about the CIA and the nuclear industry in Iran. And that's in federal court now.
Eric Friedman is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning MSU journalism professor. Duygu Kanvar also is a PhD student from Turkey here at Michigan State. We're talking about the imprisonment of journalists around the world. Eric, how do your students respond when this topic comes up in class?
I think it's, for them, it's difficult to understand until you have a dramatic incident like the beheadings that resonate across the spectrum, because unless it's somebody familiar or an American, they're not likely to pay attention to it because the American media doesn't do a good job of covering these kinds of incidents. Arrests in Russia of journalists have recently gotten attention in the U.S. press because it's part of President Putin's increasingly authoritarian style of governance. Deaths in Ukraine during the conflict with the Russians and the Ukrainians because of the news happening there. But when it's a more routine kind of story in Pakistan or in elsewhere in the Middle East or Latin America, the American press doesn't cover it, so I don't think our students are as aware of it. It's one of the reasons why groups like Reporters Without Borders and Committee to Protect Journalists are so active in trying to publicize these situations.
Duygu Kanvar, are you interested in covering stories in hotspots around the world?
Yes,
what?
I am.
You are.
And actually, I was going to add something to what Dr. Friedman said here.
Sure.
So the journalist imprisonments in Turkey have been going on for a long time. And only 5-6 years ago, when mainstream journalists were imprisoned, people became aware of the situation that was going on. I mean, there were Turkish and Kurdish journalists that were in prison for a long time, and none of the Turkish citizens knew about that because, like he said, they weren't interested in the issue. Back then, it was more about terrorism and, you know, promoting Kurdish separatism in the press, and people were just jailed because of those reasons. But like I said, even the Turkish citizens didn't know about the situation that was going on.
Where would, if you had your choice of assignments around the world to cover whatever story you wanted, what would you choose?
Well, right now, the Middle East is really both dangerous, and then it is, you know, there are a lot of valuable information to cover there, I guess. I would want to go to maybe Ukraine or Russia. But yeah, probably those spots.
Eric, what do you make of the risks that freelancers face when covering stories around the world? A lot of times these people don't have really close ties to a news organization. Both Foley and Sotloff were freelancers, for example.
They were both freelancers, and increasingly journalists who cover foreign events are freelancers because the major news media in the U.S. and Europe are cutting back on their staff coverage. Let me just give you a quick example. When I was in Tajikistan a couple of years ago interviewing journalists, I interviewed a BBC stringer who had been jailed. He was accused of being a terrorist because he reported about terrorists. And because of his connection with the BBC, the British government put pressure on the government of Tajikistan, and so he was released before trial. He spent, as I recall, about 6 weeks in jail, but he did have that organization behind him. But most freelancers don't. They don't have that kind of political and economic support.
Mm-hmm. There is an interesting discussion going on right now involving ransom as well, and I want to ask you about this. This is indirectly related, at least to our topic. Some governments are willing to pay them to free their citizens. Others, including most notably the United States and Britain, if I'm not mistaken, do not. What do you make of that discussion?
I can't say that one political philosophy of paying and another of not paying is good policy or bad policy. I would note that both the U.S. and the U.K. have the military alternative means that many other countries don't to try and rescue citizens, not just journalists. They could be diplomats or business people or oil industry workers who are being held hostage. And then there are negotiations that go on below the surface, even between the U.S. government and countries that may hold our citizens, like Iran. And we say we don't negotiate, but we really do.
Speaking of what goes below the surface, don't some kidnappings of reporters go unreported because the government or their employers decide that the publicity would put them at even greater risk? I mean, are there cases we don't know about until after they're released or maybe even killed?
That's happened in a number of places, including Africa and Latin America. Part of it is, as you say, because they don't want to draw attention to what might be negotiations. But there have also been dozens of journalists who have disappeared, and we don't know whether they were abducted, whether they were murdered, whether they left their country of their own volition without telling their families or their employers. And some of those cases are the ones that I think you refer to, where the family and employer know they're disappeared, but the government may know that they've actually been kidnapped and are being held either as hostages for ransom or, as the case of the beheading show, being held for political reasons.
One of the books you're using to teach master's students about global affairs is the book written by NPR's Anne Garrell, Naked in Baghdad, and there are others. What do these books written by reporters in the field bring to your classroom?
First of all, they bring first-person stories about how reporting is done. So in Anne Garrell's wonderful book, you learn how she works with fixers, how bribes are paid to get across borders or past security checkpoints. You learn about the connection between American or Western journalists and their local translators and freelancers and fixers. And you also learn how many of those foreign nationals who help American correspondents are at risk of their own lives in retaliation for cooperating with the Western press.
The U.S. government has abandoned a lot of these translators in Afghanistan, if I'm not mistaken.
And Iraq. They've denied them or their families visas to emigrate to the United States, or they've delayed the issuance of a visa so long that the person has been killed or family members have been threatened.
How much does this hurt our ability to report from these countries in the future?
Good question. I think there'll always be people willing to assist journalists because they want the story to be told as well, and they have the language skills or the political connections or the cultural and tribal connections. But the threat in many of the cases is not to themselves, but they worry mostly about their families. And it's much easier for the United States to take one translator into protective custody and help that person get out than it is to take a large family and relocate them.
Doigu, do these risks give you any pause about a career traveling the world in the field of journalism?
No, actually not at all. Coming from a country that was just by last year known as world's worst jailer for journalists, I have been studying journalism for 4 years now, and I'm going to continue doing this. So no, it doesn't discourage me at all.
We want to thank our guest, Doigu Kanvar, a PhD student here at Michigan State University from Turkey. Her master's thesis was on the imprisonment of Turkish journalists. Also, thanks to Eric Friedman, MSU journalism professor and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter teaching here at Michigan State. Many thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.